Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present St. Martin Episode 1, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 1, Dawn of the First People. The origins of St. Martin and the spirit of its first inhabitants. Before the arrival of foreign ships, before the ambitions of kings and merchants stretched across the Atlantic, before maps were inked with borders dividing lands never meant to be divided, there was only the sea, the sky, and the unbroken song of the wind whispering through the hills of a land that would one day be called St. Martin. It was a paradise untouched by time, where the rhythms of the natural world dictated the way of life, and the great blue ocean was not a barrier but a bridge, one that connected the first settlers to the pulse of a wider Caribbean world. The first settlers, keepers of the land and sea. The first to walk the shores of St. Martin were the Arawaks, a peaceful, seafaring people who had spent generations mastering the shifting moods of the Caribbean waters. They came from the heart of South America, following the currents that whispered secrets of distant lands. The Arawaks were not wanderers without purpose. They were navigators, guided by the sun and stars, their wooden canoes slicing through the tides with a certainty that spoke of ancient knowledge passed down through generations. As they stepped onto the island's fertile soil, they found a land rich beyond measure. Towering mangroves and mahogany trees swayed with the wind's embrace. Coconut palms bent gracefully toward the sea, as if paying homage to the waves that had carried their seeds across the world. Rivers, clear as polished glass, meandered through valleys, their waters alive with fish that shimmered in the sunlight. Parrots painted the skies with streaks of emerald and crimson, their cries ringing out like laughter across the canopies. And above it all, the mountains stood as silent watchers, timeless, unmoved, and steeped in the island's spirit. The Arawaks, ever in harmony with nature, settled along the coasts, where the bounty of the sea was plentiful. Fishing, farming, and storytelling formed the backbone of their existence. They built villages of circular huts called bohayos, their thatched roofs crafted from dried palm fronds, sturdy enough to withstand the Caribbean storms. Their lives were not governed by conquest or wealth, but by the cycle of the earth and sky. They planted cassava, maize, and sweet potatoes, tending to the land with reverence, never taking more than it could give. Their hands wove intricate baskets, their fingers sculpted pottery adorned with symbols of their myths and gods. Their voices carried the oral histories of ancestors who had once stood where they now stood. To the Arawaks, the land was not merely a place to live. It was alive, and they were its caretakers. The gods, the spirits, and the myths of the Arawaks. At the heart of Arawak life was their spiritual connection to the natural world. They believed that every river, every stone, every whisper of the wind held the essence of the divine. Their gods were not distant rulers, but forces woven into the fabric of existence, present in the rustling of the leaves, the crash of the waves, the flicker of firelight in the night. They spoke of Yukahu, the great spirit of the sky, the unseen force that breathed life into the land. He was the giver of cassava, the sustainer of their people, the one who watched over the sea's endless horizon. But where there was light, there was also shadow. Jurikin, the vengeful spirit of storms, lurked in the heavens, his fury unleashed upon the world in the form of tempests that could tear villages from the earth and scatter them into the abyss of the sea. To appease the gods, the Arawaks held ceremonial dances, where drums thundered like the heartbeat of the island, where painted faces flickered in the glow of sacred fires, and where voices rose in songs older than memory itself. Through these rituals, they sought balance, not just with the gods, but with the land, the ocean, and the spirits of those who had come before them. The Carib arrival, a shift in power. For centuries, the Arawaks lived in peace, their existence a testament to their harmony with the island. But peace in the Caribbean was never eternal. From the south, across the same waters that had once carried their ancestors, came another people. fierce, untamed, warborn. The Caribs, the very name would one day give rise to the word Caribbean, were warriors. Unlike the Arawaks, their society was built not just on survival, but on conquest. They saw the sea not as a gentle provider, but as a battlefield. Their canoes were sleek, fast, designed for war, their weapons sharp, their resolve unshakable. The Caribs did not seek to coexist, they sought to dominate. The Arawaks, caught between their way of life and the force of a new era, resisted, but their weapons of wood and stone were no match for the sharpened obsidian-tipped arrows and the unyielding ferocity of their invaders. One by one, villages fell, their huts turned to ash, their people taken as captives or forced to flee into the forests and hills, where the whispers of their ancestors could still be heard in the wind. And so the balance of power shifted. The Caribs became the new rulers of St. Martin, their presence a declaration that the age of peace had ended, and a new era, one of war and dominance, had begun. The legacy of the first people. But even in the face of conquest, even as the Arawaks faded from the island's shores, their spirit never truly vanished. Their stories still lingered in the rustling palms. Their symbols remained carved into the stones and pottery buried beneath the soil. Their prayers still echoed in the wind that swept through the hills of St. Martin. For the land never forgets those who first called it home. And neither would history. Far across the ocean, in the distant courts of Europe, the ambitions of kings and explorers were stirring. The day would come when the island's fate would no longer be decided by the Caribs or the descendants of the Arawaks, but by men who had never seen its shores. Men who saw maps and claimed lands that were never theirs to claim. And so, the stage was set for the next great upheaval. The world was coming. And St. Martin would never be the same again. Chapter 2, Columbus Shadow. 1493. The dawn of European contact and the unraveling of an untouched world. The ocean was calm that day. The Caribbean sun burned high, a golden eye upon the vast blue expanse, as the wind carried the promise of distant lands across the waves. The Caribs, now masters of St. Martin, watched the horizon with the same vigilance that had once made them feared warriors among the islands. They knew these waters well, had sailed them countless times in search of new conquests. But what they saw that morning was unlike anything they had ever known. It began as nothing more than a shadow on the sea, a dark smudge against the gleaming horizon. Then it grew, unfurling sails the size of storm clouds, towering wooden beasts riding the waves, moving toward them with an eerie and unrelenting purpose. Three vessels, alien in their construction, cutting through the currents like creatures of another world. The Caribs had no name for them yet, but history would. The largest of these ships was called La Santa Maria, and aboard it stood a man whose name would be carved into the very fabric of the Caribbean's fate, Christopher Columbus. A world unprepared for the arrival of giants. Columbus had not set sail to find St. Martin. In truth, he had no idea that the island even existed. His mission, funded by the Spanish crown, was one of greed disguised as destiny. He sought riches beyond imagination, new lands to claim, new people to convert, control, and conquer. He had already landed in the Caribbean the previous year, making contact with the Taino of Hispaniola, leaving behind a colony in his wake. Now, on this second voyage, he was hungry for more. On November 11, 1493, Columbus sighted St. Martin, along with several other islands, as he navigated the northern arc of the Lesser Antilles. He did not set foot on the island itself, but his mere presence was enough to shift the course of history. For the Caribs who watched from the shore, it was a moment of profound, silent dread. They were warriors, but they were not fools. They had heard whispers carried by the sea, rumors from the larger islands to the west. Tales of pale-skinned men draped in metal, of thunderous weapons that spat fire, of disease that turned flesh to ruin. The Spanish were coming, and wherever they went, death followed in their wake. But the Caribs did not kneel. They had spent generations crushing enemies who dared threaten their way of life. And if these strangers thought they could step onto Carib lands unchallenged, they would soon learn the price of such arrogance. The first clashes, blood on the sands. The Spanish saw the Caribs not as people, but as obstacles. Unlike the more peaceful Arawaks, the Caribs would never bow to Spanish rule. This defiance enraged Columbus and his men, who saw it as justification for slaughter. The first encounters between Spanish explorers and the Caribs of St. Martin were not of diplomacy, but of war. The Caribs launched fierce attacks on Spanish landing parties, striking from the dense underbrush, their bows and poisoned arrows far deadlier than the Spanish had anticipated. They were masters of ambush, their canoes swift and maneuverable, allowing them to raid and disappear before the Spanish could mount a proper defense. But the Spanish had their own weapons, weapons that the Caribs had never faced before. Steel swords, sharp enough to slice through bone. Arquebuses, early firearms that erupted like thunder, striking men dead from distances the Caribs had never imagined. War dogs, massive and brutal, trained to tear apart enemies with terrifying precision. Yet even with these weapons, the Spanish found conquering the Caribs to be no easy task. The warriors of St. Martin and the surrounding islands fought with the desperation of a people who knew what was at stake. Their land, their families, their very existence. And so, the waters of the Caribbean ran red. The Spanish's dark intentions. To the Spanish, the Caribs were not just an enemy. They were a commodity. Columbus had made a promise to the Spanish crown that he would deliver slaves in great numbers, men and women who could be put to work in the mines and plantations that Spain intended to build. And so, when the Spanish did capture Caribs, they did not execute them. No, they chained them, dragged them aboard their ships, and sold them into slavery. It was a fate worse than death. Many would never see their homeland again. Many would die before even reaching Spanish shores, their bodies discarded into the depths of the ocean. This marked the beginning of the end for the Caribs' dominion over St. Martin. They fought. They resisted. But against the relentless tide of Spanish expansion, their once unbreakable grip on the island began to weaken. A divided fate, the shifting powers over St. Martin. Despite their brutality, the Spanish did not hold St. Martin for long. The island was too small, too isolated, and there were larger prizes elsewhere: Hispaniola, Puerto Rico, Cuba. The Spanish eventually abandoned their attempts to maintain control over the island, shifting their focus toward richer colonies. For a time, St. Martin remained in a state of limbo, claimed by Spain, but left largely untouched, save for the Caribs who still called it home. But Columbus' shadow had already been cast. His voyage had set a precedent, an invitation for the other great European powers to come and take what they believed to be theirs by divine right. The Spanish may have moved on, but others were watching. The French, the Dutch, the English. They had seen what Columbus had done, and they wanted their share. The foreshadowing of a divided island. As the 16th century progressed, the Caribbean transformed into a chessboard of European ambition. France, the Netherlands, and England began making their first explorations of the region, seeking trade routes, wealth, and new territories. St. Martin, once nothing more than a small island in the path of a wandering explorer, was now a coveted prize. And soon, it would become something even more, a battleground. But before war could decide its fate, before treaties and flags carved it into two halves, the first seeds of colonization had to be planted. And that is exactly what would happen next. The age of European settlement was about to begin, and with it, the true struggle for St. Martin's soul. Chapter 3: The Struggle for Control. The Battle for St. Martin and the Birth of a Divided Island, 1500 to 1648. The Spanish had come and gone, leaving behind only the scars of their presence. The Caribs, once the undisputed masters of St. Martin, had fought fiercely, but even warriors of the sea could not hold back the tide of foreign conquest forever. The world beyond the Caribbean was shifting, and with it came the rise of new empires, each eager to lay claim to lands not their own. But St. Martin, small and seemingly unremarkable, was different. It was not a land of golden cities or boundless riches. It was a gateway, a strategic foothold in the growing chessboard of the Caribbean, a place that could serve as a trade outpost, a military stronghold, and a stepping stone for those who sought dominion over the seas. And so, the battle for St. Martin was not one fought in a single day, nor by a single empire. It was a war woven across generations, a conflict between nations that would shape the identity of the island forever. The Spanish claim and the era of abandonment. By the early 1500s, Spain had turned its attention elsewhere. The islands of Hispaniola, Puerto Rico, and Cuba were far more valuable, offering access to gold mines, plantation wealth, and indigenous labor. St. Martin, with its rugged terrain and lack of immediate resources, was left in relative obscurity. Yet Spain still claimed it as their own. Their maps bore the mark of Spanish sovereignty, even as their ships rarely touched its shores. They considered it part of their vast empire, a possession by declaration rather than presence. For a time, the island seemed almost forgotten. The Caribs, though weakened, remained rebuilding what they could, reclaiming the lands where their ancestors had walked. But the silence would not last. For beyond the horizon, two great powers were watching. The Dutch and the French arrive. By the late 1500s, Spain's dominance in the Caribbean had begun to falter. The vast wealth it had drained from the New World had made it the most powerful empire in Europe, but power breeds enemies. The Dutch and the French, locked in struggles against Spain in Europe, saw an opportunity. If they could carve out their own presence in the Caribbean, they could break Spain's grip on the seas. And St. Martin, small though it was, stood in a perfect position for such ambitions. The Dutch came first. The Dutch West India Company, an emerging commercial giant, sought trade routes, sugar plantations, and harbors for their growing fleet. The Dutch saw the Caribbean not just as land to conquer, but as a network of profitable colonies. St. Martin, with its natural salt ponds, was a prize of economic value, as salt was a critical resource for preserving food. The French followed soon after. France, under the rule of Louis XIII, was beginning to expand its presence in the New World, sending explorers, traders, and settlers to the Americas. Unlike the Dutch, who were focused on commerce, the French saw St. Martin as a potential colony, a place to cultivate and control. The battle for the island. The first settlements were small, makeshift outposts, built by Dutch and French sailors who had no intention of leaving without a fight. But Spain, though distracted, had not yet relinquished its claim. When word reached Spanish officials that both the Dutch and the French had begun encroaching upon St. Martin, the response was swift and brutal. In 1633, Spain launched an assault on the Dutch settlements, sending warships to drive them out. The Dutch, despite their naval strength, were caught off guard. The Spanish took control of Fort Amsterdam, located near present-day Philipsburg, and erected their own fortifications to prevent further intrusions. For 14 years, Spain held the island in a state of militarized isolation. But their grip was never truly secure. The island was difficult to maintain, offering no gold, no great cities, only small settlements and rugged hills. The Dutch and the French, relentless in their pursuit of Caribbean dominance, waited for the perfect moment to reclaim what they had started. The Treaty of Concordia, A Divided Fate, 1648. By the mid-1600s, Spain's empire was stretched thin. War in Europe, rebellions in the Americas, and economic troubles at home made holding onto distant islands unsustainable. And so, in 1648, Spain abandoned St. Martin, retreating from a land that had become more of a liability than a treasure. What followed was one of the most unique moments in Caribbean history. Rather than one European power seizing full control, two agreed to share it. The Dutch and the French, long-standing rivals, came together and signed the Treaty of Concordia, an agreement that would split the island into two territories, giving birth to the dual-nation identity that defines St. Martin to this day. The division was not drawn in blood, but in ink, an unusual resolution in an age when European empires carved up lands with the edge of a sword. The treaty declared that both nations would coexist, trade freely, and defend the island together against outside threats. But peace, as history often proves, is never as simple as a signature. The tensions of coexistence. At first, the arrangement was functional. The Dutch controlled the southern half of the island, focusing on trade, salt production, and commerce. The French occupied the northern half, where they aimed to establish farms, settlements, and plantations. But beneath the surface, tensions simmered. The division was not a perfect line, and both sides sought to expand their influence. Smugglers, traders, and settlers often ignored borders, leading to disputes, skirmishes, and power struggles. Even the Caribs, long displaced, remained a force lurking in the background, resisting European rule in whatever ways they could. The island's indigenous identity was fading, but it had not yet been erased. And so, the seeds of centuries of conflict were planted in the soil of St. Martin. The island had been claimed, abandoned, fought over, and finally divided. But its true struggle had only just begun. The dawn of a new era. With the Treaty of Concordia, the future of St. Martin was forever altered. The island had become a symbol of European ambition, a land where commerce, culture, and conflict would intertwine for generations to come. But as plantations spread, as enslaved Africans were brought to work the fields, and as European settlers reshaped the land, one question remained unanswered. Would this shared rule lead to a thriving partnership? Or would St. Martin become a battlefield once more? The answer lay in the years ahead, years that would bring slavery, rebellion, revolution, and war. and the island's people would soon learn that the true cost of colonization was only beginning to be paid. Chapter 4. The Age of Sugar, Slavery, and Rebellion. 1648 to 1800. The rise of the plantation economy and the struggle for freedom. The ink had barely dried on the Treaty of Concordia when the true shape of St. Martin's future began to reveal itself. The Dutch and French, once mere explorers and traders, were no longer just visitors to these shores. They were now masters of the land, carving out a new world with European hands. But their ambitions did not end with governance. They sought wealth, and in the Caribbean, there was one path to fortune greater than all others. Sugar. The white gold of the New World, as it was called, transformed islands into empires. The great sugar plantations of Hispaniola, Jamaica, and Barbados had already made their nations powerful beyond measure, and St. Martin, though smaller, was not exempt from this fate. But sugar had a cost not paid in coin or silver, but in human suffering. For to make sugar, they needed slaves. The birth of the plantation economy. The French and Dutch settlers, eager to capitalize on their new claims, began to divide the land into plantations. The fertile valleys of the island, where the soil was rich and the climate ideal, became vast fields of sugarcane, stretching as far as the eye could see. The settlers built grand estates, importing machinery and refining techniques from other islands. The Dutch, masters of trade and commerce, established connections with West African slave traders, bringing shiploads of enslaved people across the Atlantic in the most brutal journey known to mankind, the Middle Passage. Men, women, and children were ripped from their homes, shackled together in the dark, putrid holds of ships, their bodies packed so tightly that many did not survive the voyage. Those who did arrive in St. Martin were greeted not with opportunity, but with chains and the crack of the whip. Life under the lash, the reality of slavery on St. Martin. For the enslaved, life was not life at all. It was endurance in the face of torment. They awoke before dawn, the sound of the overseer's whip slicing the air. They worked under the punishing Caribbean sun, their hands cut and bleeding from the sharp edges of the sugarcane. They were fed just enough to keep them standing, housed in cramped, windowless huts, with little more than dirt beneath them to rest upon. The punishment for resistance was severe. Those who ran were hunted like animals, dragged back to the plantation in iron collars, their flesh branded or stripped away beneath the lash. Some were forced to wear muzzles, designed to keep them from speaking or eating without permission. Others were hanged, their bodies left on display as a warning to those who dared dream of freedom. Yet, despite the suffering, the enslaved held on to their humanity. They found strength in song, in whispered prayers, in stolen moments of joy. They passed down the stories of their ancestors, the traditions of Africa woven into the fabric of their new existence. They resisted, not always with open rebellion, but with small acts of defiance, breaking tools to slow the work, feigning illness to rest their bodies, teaching their children the names of their homeland, so they would never forget who they were. But for some, quiet resistance was not enough. They wanted freedom, and they would take it by force. The first uprisings, fire in the fields. As the years passed, the enslaved grew restless. Across the Caribbean, whispers of revolution spread like wildfire. In Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, enslaved people rose up against their French masters, setting in motion the greatest slave rebellion in history. Their victory would shake the world. St. Martin, too, was not immune to these currents of rebellion. Throughout the 1700s, small revolts erupted across the island, each one a desperate attempt to break the chains that bound them. In 1725, a group of enslaved men escaped into the hills, forming the first Maroon community, living as free people beyond the reach of the plantations. In 1750, a plantation was burned to the ground, its owner found dead by the hands of those he had once owned. By the late 1700s, the fear of insurrection gripped the island, with slave owners doubling their patrols, fearful that every shadow, every whisper, was the beginning of an uprising. But even in the face of cruelty, change was coming. The very foundations of slavery were beginning to tremble, and across the world, the voices of abolition grew louder. The French Revolution and the first taste of freedom. In 1789, revolution erupted in France, sending shockwaves across the Atlantic. The ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity reached even the farthest corners of the empire, igniting the hope that the age of oppression was coming to an end. For the enslaved people of French St. Martin, this was a moment of reckoning. In 1794, The revolutionary government of France officially abolished slavery in its territories, declaring that all men were free. But on the Dutch side of the island, nothing changed. The Dutch settlers refused to recognize the decree, continuing the enslavement of thousands, determined to hold on to their power. What followed was a divided island, where freedom existed only in name, where enslaved people on one side of the border risked their lives to reach the other, where families were torn apart, and where the fight for true liberation had only just begun. The seeds of the future, the unfinished struggle. By the dawn of the 19th century, St. Martin stood at a crossroads. The age of slavery was winding toward its inevitable end, but the battle was not yet won. On the French side, the abolition of slavery in 1794 was short-lived. By 1802, Napoleon reinstated slavery, plunging the island back into the nightmare of bondage. On the Dutch side, slavery remained untouched, entrenched in the economy, upheld by men who refused to relinquish their grip on power. The enslaved people, however, were no longer willing to wait. Every year, more escaped, resisted, and fought, fueling a fire that could never be extinguished. The years ahead would bring war, abolition, and the birth of a new St. Martin. But for now, the island remained shackled, caught in the final, desperate throes of a system that could not, would not last forever. The question was no longer if slavery would end. It was when. And when that day came, the people of St. Martin would be ready.